Welcome to the Kriya Yoga Podcast, a source of inspiration and actionable education for those inspired towards the goal of enlightenment through yogic meditation. Through these interviews, discussions, and reflections, it is my intention to share the possibility of waking up to the reality of self and God realization, and to remind you of the immortal words of Paramahansa Yogananda. Don't look back. Don't look to the left or to the right. Look straight ahead to the goal and go all the way in this lifetime. I'm Ryan Kurzak, and I'll be your host on this adventure of spiritual self-discovery. Welcome back, everyone, to the Kriya Yoga Podcast. We are just now getting into season two, and I have another great guest for us today, Ray Booker. He's a student of Roy Eugene Davis and a Kriya Yoga teacher, an Ayurvedic practitioner, a musician, and a single parent, and also a self-proclaimed neophyte in Sanskrit. So it's good to see you, Ray. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. I'm glad to be here.
So what I'd like to get into, if you don't mind, first of all, just to introduce people to you, can you tell me about your relationship with Roy, how you met Roy, and how you became interested in Kriya Yoga?
Yes, I'd be glad to share that, because I look back, of course, with big smiles and much joy on my time with Roy. Beginning in the mid-70s, I did what a lot of folks did. I turned a bit inward and got some readings, and one of those readings was Autobiography of a Yogi. Mm-hmm. I think that was around 1975. I read that along with a couple of other books by a Russian mystic called G.I. Gurdjieff. Mm-hmm. And that came into play, as I will get to here in a minute, in a very odd way. I read Autobiography of a Yogi, said, that was really interesting. Wow, these people are doing these things. They're leaving their bodies. They're doing all this wonderful things. More importantly, though, it gave me an inner buzz, let's say. There was just a feeling, an energetic that jumped out of the pages with that. Go forward a couple of years, I began hanging out with a Gurdjieff group in Anchorage, Alaska, which led me to spend a year in England studying various techniques, let's just say so-called metaphysical techniques is the label that was put on them. And that whole thing got blown up by the interjection of a yogi who called himself simply Dadaji, a very anonymous name.
Okay.
But in part, he wrote a letter to the director of the program I was there in for a year and said, oh, what you're doing is BS. He didn't quite use those, but he said, you should be doing yoga sadhana. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what that meant at the time. I had, you know, read some yogic terms in Autobiography of a Yogi, of course. So I got a bunch of books, put them in a couple of boxes for my trip back over from England, where this program was. And then I left the Gurdjieff group. It didn't feel right to me anymore. There's something about Dadaji's letters that told me, leave it alone. So I entered into my householder period of life in the 80s, became a techie type of a guy, and began raising my two boys. I had one son who at that time had spent his first grade in England, and then a new one that was welcomed in 1981. But when I was doing that, there was something that was missing. It was interesting, challenging intellectually and all of that, but there was still a bit of a gap. So I decided, okay, I'm going to begin reading again and taking some time after work to look at some things. So I went to my bookcase and stood in front of it and said, I'm going to just find this or allow myself to be led to a book. Mm-hmm. So I reach in the bookshelf and I pull out a book, and it's Studies in Truth by some guy named Roy Eugene Davis.
How'd it get in your bookshelf?
Good question. When I was in England, they had a place called Coombe Springs Press, but they were pretty much interested in Gurdjieff's writings and publishing those books and all of that. And also the writings of a gentleman named Idris Shah, dealing with the Sufi approach to life and other things. The Sufi stuff was very interesting to me. So I had a lot of books by Idris Shah, some books by Ospensky, Gurdjieff. I had no idea who Roy Eugene Davis was. I, to this day, have no idea of how that book got into my boxes of books. I had two boxes of books. Okay, I'm just chuckling as I remember this. Two boxes of books that I had sent back over. One was Lost at Sea.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I never got that. But the one that made it had Studies of Truth in it.
Maybe so, you got someone else's box.
Yeah. And either way, I don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a very fortuitous. So I looked at it and said, okay, this is the book that wound up in my hand. It looked like it was a series of lectures. So I said, okay, each day when I get off from work, I'm going to sit and I'm going to read one of this gentleman's lectures beginning tomorrow. So the next day I make it home after work and I sit down, pull my chair up to the window, prop my feet up and begin reading. And my, oh my, my, oh my. I read that first lecture and it was a combination of, okay, feels good to come home.
Yeah.
You know, and at the same time, I think I literally had tears coming to my eyes. So I was, you know, I was lucky I was alone there. So my macho image didn't get affected.
Right. But,
you know, the techies I work with, what are you crying for, man?
Yeah. Yeah, but, I'm sure. But, and the musicians too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No crying on stage. No babies allowed. And I read that first lecture and I wanted to continue, but I said, no, do it one at a time. There's a lot here that's going in. Mm-hmm. Don't burn the circuits out, so to speak. So for the next month or so, I would get off of work and read a bit and read a bit. This is in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And I, as I say, I knew I was home. So in 1994, I call the number in the back of the book. And it was either Willie or Kath that answered the phone. And I said, you know, hi, I'm Ray Booker. I'm here in Alaska and I'd like to come and see you guys. And they said, oh yeah, come on down. And I said, well, okay, I'll see you next year. And they said, oh, I said, yes, I want to give myself a year to prepare. Mm. And so that was late spring of 94. So I bought a book by Satchidananda called Integral Yoga Hatha. Mm-hmm. And I sit with it and as best as I knew how, made out a routine. So, you know, began getting up at 4:30 every morning and doing my little Hatha routine and approaching meditation as best I could from what I had read, you know, from Roy and things. Cleaned up my diet, my lifestyle, began eating vegetarian again. I had for about 10 years prior and then gave that up when I became isolated in the countryside in England. So it was by a matter of necessity.
Right.
And in 95, I went down. And Bob Binney, the honey man, mm-hmm. picked me up. As it turned out, he and I were both from Alaska. He had been from Alaska. So we're chatting on the way from Tocoa in the train station all the way in about Alaska. And we went right past TSA. This is about midnight one night.
Yeah.
And Bob, I don't know where we were. All I know is dark and here we are. So Bob realized that, oh, we're not in Kansas anymore, Ray. And he turned the car around and we went back. And of course, then the next morning, I went to the first session there with Roy. And this is interesting. You may have an understanding of this. When I first got there, even though I had prepared for a year, I found myself not being drawn to sit in the front of the room, you know, let me be close to this guy, et cetera. I found myself wanting to sit in the back row, back in the corner.
Yeah.
You know? And so I just very shyly for the next 5 days sit in the back in the corner and got good. And it was then, of course, during that July the 6th, 1995, that Roy then initiated me into Kriya Yoga.
Yeah. Well, I sat in the middle. I didn't go all the way back and I didn't go all the way front. I just sat in the middle on the first retreat. Good. So that was when you first met him in 96 or 95. 95. Yeah. 95. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then did you come back often after that? Or, I mean, Alaska is pretty far away, so I'm not sure how realistic that is.
It was challenging, especially with the job that I had that demanded a lot of travel in the Northwest and in Alaska. So my schedule was very fluid, let's say. Mm-hmm. But I made it a point to go down at least twice a year. I would go. And interesting enough, I began to feel something there because I knew that, okay, it's kind of good to hang around this guy, you know, mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. And so when I would set and say, okay, just bring to mind, that's where I wish to be. That's where I wish to be. That the work schedule would open up. The family life would open up. Yeah. And I could get myself on a plane and travel there. So initially... twice a year. Sometimes, of course, there would be a bump in the road and mm-hmm. I would only make it once. But I knew after a bit. Well, in 97, I took an extended time off, a month off, because Roy did a sojourn to India in 97, mm-hmm. just 2 years afterwards. So I went ahead and joined him.
Mm-hmm. So you went on the India tour with him?
Yeah. That was a very good, we'll just stay with simple adjectives here mm-hmm. Because sometimes there aren't words.
Right. So you ended up going to like Shrikteshwar's ashram and Yogananda's places and so on. Was it that kind of a trip?
Yeah, it was. We went from when we got to, I'm trying to remember where Yukteswar's place was there.
Puri?
No, it'll come to me here. Yeah. Anyway, we were there and there was the Ganges. But the place at the time was closed. Oh, excuse me, that was Lahiri's. Excuse me. But the place was closed up. When we got to Calcutta, Roy had access via Yogananda's grandnephew, I believe.
Yeah.
To Yogananda's childhood home. And so we were able to go in and, you know, with what I had encountered just from being around Roy, being there in the ground of the CSA, there's an energetic, as you know, that is imbued into places where there is that enlivening spirit.
Right.
And going into Yogananda's home, and standing in front of the altar where he as a child, you know, had constructed things. Wow. I wish I had, you know, more elaborate words. But,
sometimes it's all you need.
Yeah. Standing there was electrifying.
Yeah.
You know, it was really... Getting there was an adventure. Roy had a cab driver. We had a convoy of us that were traveling there in a cab, and we got lost. The cab drivers got lost. And I have a picture that's near and dear to me these days of Roy unfolding a map on the hood of a car, pointing to where he wanted to go to the cab driver to direct the cab driver to where we wanted to get.
That's fantastic.
On the side streets of Calcutta, yeah. So...
As you got more involved in Kriya Yoga, I know you had mentioned previously when we had talked that one of the important things of your life is music and how that impacted your practice. And so I'm curious if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, as a young man, I was around music. My parents weren't musicians, but I was around music, and a lot of musicians dropped by the house. It intrigued me. I'm a math guy, very much a numbers guy. And you may hear at times that musicians usually have an inclination towards math or whatever. And that's true. And combine that with that creativeness, as we would say in Ayurveda. As I got older, I wanted to learn to play. But I hit those teenage years, Ryan. I bought the guitar, and I knew I was going to be the next Jimi Hendrix.
You and me both, right?
Yeah, I knew it. But not many other people did, and so that never occurred. I wound up being a bass player instead. And as I went through my music career, I became a single parent early on in my music career. I think I was 20. My teenage years, I was traveling a lot on the road, playing music, very loud music, by the way. And when I became a single parent, then that all stopped. That brought things more in.
Right.
I thank my oldest son to this day for bringing me in off the road and calming me down there. But as I got into music and I got away from that pitta-ness of it, come see me, watch what I can do. I began to go inward with it and to study. Could not afford to go to the Berklee School of Music, which I wanted to, as a single parent, and things just wasn't a practical thing to do.
Right.
Monetarily and for my son. So I began a series of self-study and hanging with a lot of older musicians and did a correspondence course via Berklee. And I found that to be very interesting, especially after reading Autobiography of a Yogi and becoming involved with Kriya, because you face challenges, as you may know yourself from playing music, as you learn something new. Those challenges aren't only physical, what you can physically do on the instrument. It's also what you encounter inwardly, how you face those challenges,
right,
how you visualize your way through those challenges. Found visualization, my sense of visualization or my familiarity of the use of visualization matured and became more solidified as I was learning and teaching myself music. Because I had to face those things that I ran into in myself that said, no, you can't do that.
Right.
And I would say, okay. In the words of the great prophet Bruno Mars, don't believe me, just watch. And so I would be persistent. And to this day, there are things that I'm still practicing that I could not do 30 or 40 years ago.
Right.
I still can't do them, but I'm still practicing them.
Yeah.
And so by facing those things in myself, using visualization, using, visualizing myself playing that difficult piece, visualizing myself memorizing something that I didn't think I could memorize, visualizing myself doing a concert that I was asked to do that I accepted, but I felt you aren't ready to play with these musicians yet, but I said yes anyway.
Yeah.
So I developed habits, but more importantly than the habits that I developed was the learning about how this embodied Ray moves and works,
right,
how he works with himself, how is he kind to himself. It became very clear to me from working with myself that unless I was kind to myself, unless I was generous with myself, and understanding that I couldn't really fully be that with others.
Right.
And so music has been a gateway for me.
Yeah. One thing one thing that I was teaching a class a few years ago, and I was learning a difficult piece that I'd been studying for probably over a year. And I realized that I didn't think I could do it. And as I was teaching this class, it occurred to me, I had to feel as though I could, as though the possibility was there. And so during that class, I just changed the way I was thinking about things. And then I took a break during one of the class lectures because it was online. It was, you know, when we all had to be online. And within a matter of 45 minutes, I learned half of this piece, all from that moment that my mind shifted. And I actually told the class that about how, you know, these things that you think you can't understand or that are beyond you, if you can try to at least imagine that it's possible and what it would feel like if you could, maybe that can help. And so I'm curious, is that the kind of thing you're talking about? Or are you talking more about like a specific kind of way of visualizing an experience?
I would say you nailed that. That's really what it is. That subtle shift in perspective, just that. And it's a very, you know, subtle, it's probably different for us all, but as you were describing that, I was seeing myself again in that space, you know, of making that shift in perspective, you know, and then doing that. And so I would say you described it very well, in terms of my experience there.
And I think things like music and really anything where you have to kind of put your attention towards it is really helpful in yoga, because I can remember, I'm not sure if it was Roy said this or if I remember reading Yogananda saying this about James Lynn. You know, he was a successful business person, and it was said that he was so successful in yoga and his meditation practice because he was also successful in another area of his life. And so it's like those lessons or those ideas of success also translate between spiritual and material worlds in a way.
Yes, they absolutely do. I remember sitting with Roy in the chalet more than once, nearing my retirement. And of course, he would always ask me, "What are your plans? What are your plans?" And I would sometimes be wholly unprepared, you know, because I'm thinking, you know, so I would say something.
You knew it was coming, Ray.
I knew it was coming, you know. But sometimes it was what they call deductive reasoning. I knew from just a glance from him what I was not going to do.
Right.
You know, when I told him once we were in the truck heading into town, he swung by the house out there on a solitary retreat and said, "Hey, I'm heading into town. Jump in the truck." So I jump in the truck and we're heading down the hill. And he asked me the question again, "What are your plans?" I'm thinking, well, I thought we were just going, you know, into town, Roy. You know, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, I said, I've been thinking about becoming an Ayurvedic chef. And I'll never forget this. As we're speaking, Ryan, I can see it now. He turned to me and he just chuckled. It was in that moment I knew I was not going to be an Ayurvedic chef.
What was he hoping for? Was there a sense of what he was hoping for?
I don't think he was hoping for anything specific.
Yeah.
You know, but it was more something that was in step naturally for me.
Right.
You know, and the path was wide open. But the flavor of the path, you know, as long as I was true to the flavor of it. And that chuckle told me that wasn't being true. But he also told me, you know, when we were sitting in the chalet, I got sidetracked by the chef story because that just popped in, but that still cracks me up. He would speak to what you just spoke of. He would say to me, he says, you know, as I was a project manager, a large systems project manager for a very large computer company. And so there are habits you develop. You have to be very organized. You had to be able to visualize things as, you know, as they're going to be, but also manage things as they are to get to where they're going to be.
Right.
And he told me more than once sitting in the chalet, remember what you've learned and the habits that you have developed in your secular life, in your job life, will be very useful to you spiritually. And he said that to me more than the fingers that I have.
Yeah.
And so I began to really listen to that because I, you know, coming up to that time, there was my life, so to speak, you know, my going to work, my taking care of my children, my interacting with other folks, my going to a gig as a musician and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there was my time when I got off from work, when I would sit and read Roy's writings, and then I would do my meditations, and I'd be a good little yogling and you know, do my pranayams and all that kind of a thing. But what began to occur when he began speaking to me in that way, I began to realize that there's only one life that I'm experiencing right now. You know, there isn't this life, that life, my spiritual life, that whatever. I'm living or experiencing this life now as it unfolds. And that was one of those seismic shifts, as they would say. I then understood that all of my interactions and relationships mattered in the sense of the intention and attention that I brought to them.
Right.
And I heard something that really stuck with me, which is where your prana follows attention, prana being that life force.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, of course, doing yoga nidra, something like yoga nidra, bringing, you know, your attention to various parts of the body, that is quite true. One can experience that, you know, quite definitely. But in life, which can get very busy and dizzying at times, that sometimes you can get a little bit lost in it until you stop and breathe.
Right.
Oh, yeah, here I am. This is where I've been all the time. And so all those little interactions begin to flesh out and mean more. And a saying I had heard, the one thing I heard Gurdjieff say, if you can learn to serve a man a cup of tea, you'll be awake. And I realized then that every little interaction, just that handing of a cup of tea to someone, done mm-hmm. with attention and intention, can imbue a very subtle energetic. And yeah. as Roy, you know, spoke to me more about coalescing what I've learned as I was doing my householder duties, and bringing that into everything that I do, including, you know, those practices that I learned from him. Like I say, it was a seismic shift in perspective.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of, actually, just before we got on this talk here, I was finishing up a podcast that's on chapter 7 of Roy's book, Absolute Knowledge That Liberates Consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of that chapter is Infinite Life. And I remember him often having this theme of like asking people, how do you want to live your infinite life? And it reminds me of what you're talking about in that, you know, we have to remember that this is our infinite life. And so every moment we are engaged in that infinite life, it's not like it's all divided up. Everything works together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, out of curiosity, when he was encouraging you to remember the things you learned in your secular life, you know, mm-hmm. my question would be, is what are one or two things in particular, because, you know, you've studied with Roy since 1995, you know, you're a Kriya yoga teacher, you're an Ayurvedic practitioner, musician, all these things, single parent. If there were one or two main principles that maybe listeners, you could share with listeners, what would those be that really helped you, things that you could take from your experiences?
In terms of what we were just speaking of
yeah, like from your secular life, when Roy said, you know, don't forget those things, like what are some of those things that would kind of translate over that maybe people don't really pay that much attention to?
One is, and Roy and I had the discussion about this of all things about Tiger Woods, but it was the focus that was demanded at time. Sometimes even when I was very tired, but learning how to breathe came out of learning how to focus. So, you know, and besides, of course, I read about pranayams and I had listened intently to Roy and read, you know, Yoganandas and things, but until it becomes cellular intelligence, let's say, until it's in there, it's still intellectual. And sometimes I had to be very, very focused at work because I was what they call a large systems engineer, dealing with very large mainframes, supercomputing centers, that kind of a thing. And you had to be very focused because if you did one of those, oh, oops, it wasn't that button, it was the other button, you could change people's lives,
right?
Yeah. Especially your own.
Yeah. But,
you know, the thing is learning how, you know, by learning how to keep a lot of the times what I've seen in myself early on and with some folks that I have taught is this intellectual idea of being focused. Okay, I'm going to work with the mind and I'm going to, you know, channel it to this task and I'm going to do that. But I found that it was more than that. That it wasn't so much the straining and trying to do as much as it was of letting go. When I would be at work and be in a very stressful situation, I'll give you an example. We've all heard the Great Alaska Pipeline, mm-hmm. you know, that carries the oil. British Petroleum at that time was handling that. They were one of my accounts as an engineer. Their mainframe crashed one night and I was called in. We hooked up with Houston, and we were told that we had 90 minutes to resolve the issue or they're shutting down the pipeline.
Wow.
And that brings a little bit of pressure.
Absolutely.
And I thought, you know, I don't want to be famous tomorrow morning by having my name be in a paragraph that says, this guy shut down the pipeline. In that situation, for instance, once again, it was the focus that came, but I became conscious of breath. And it wasn't so much an intellectual thing, I'm letting go of this pressure, this, but in the breathing, it just naturally began to dissipate.
Right.
And more importantly, even though this may seem a little bit odd to folks, I didn't care anymore. Once I didn't care, my reason for not caring, let's say the liberty that I had for not caring, I knew that, okay, if we shut the pipeline down and it takes a little longer to get these things happening, no one's going to die here. There will be no loss of life.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth, but once I would learn how to let go and breathe and not care about the outcome before I got there.
Right.
Then I found myself doing naturally what I was trained to do.
Right.
All the training and all the schooling and all the natural experience I had on other systems leading up to that point just presented themselves. Okay, you've got this, this isn't happening, that isn't happening, and it's flowing because I'm not distracted by what if. You know, oops, people are watching me. Oh, this pipeline's going to shut down. It was like, let go.
Right.
In a way, don't care anymore. And we managed to reconfigure that system. The pipeline stayed up. And that was it. But all the time, I remember bringing myself back to breath, bringing myself back to breath.
Right.
And that was very useful. So in terms of focus and learning how to focus, without that intellectual straining to get there,
was
a very useful tool. Also,
go ahead.
You know, as you hear Roy would say, especially in his studies of truth, in the back of the studies of truth, he would encourage people, you know, write things down. And well, as a project manager, I had to be very organized. And so that was one thing that I learned that carried over, you know, once it came to where I didn't have to write things down, as Roy said, in studies of truth, because I had done it so much, following the flow charts, following the Gantt charts. Music had helped me to memorize.
Right.
That I could also memorize flow charts. And so I would memorize things. So when I would think of my future plans and visualize, I could memorize them and I wouldn't have to write them down. So there was that crossover there between the
right.
two.
Well, there's two things that kind of jump out at me. Number one, that idea of focus that you had and not caring. I think it's important that people recognize that when you talk about not caring, that it wasn't that you just, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth so you can correct me, but you knew what to do because you were trained.
Yes.
Which means that when you got there, you didn't have to worry about it. So that's why you could flow. And just the same thing I'm imagining with music, because I've experienced that too.
Yes.
You learn it enough, you don't have to worry about it. If you just let it go, you will do well. But there is that issue of the training first, which, you know, in yoga and meditation, you do have to train yourself in certain things. And then once you get it, though, to be able to trust yourself to let go, you know.
Yeah, so, musically, we call that pay your dues.
Pay your dues, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're absolutely right. You do the training and things so that you can let it do what it does when the time
right.
comes.
Right.
And yeah, it isn't a callous type of not caring.
Yes.
It's a not caring because you do have, exactly as you stated, you do have that foundation, that background, and you can then stand on that foundation and go about your business, you know, without having to reset as you would if you didn't have that foundation and rethink things.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned in the beginning, sort of being kind to yourself and taking care of yourself. I think that kind of speaks to, you also need to trust yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's a really, I like that. I like that you said that. Because that's something that it can sometimes be very challenging, mm-hmm. Because it can, you know, when doing something new or doing something in a stressful situation can bring about that questioning, you know, of oneself, even for those that have spent a lot of time training and learning.
Right.
But that's where the letting go part comes in. You know, like you were speaking about in music, when you practice those pieces and those fingerings and those scales and all of that. But when it comes time when that stuff lets go and the fingers are moving and there's that mind meld thing happening with the hand and, you know, you're not thinking about it. It's all that stuff starting to, you have your own way.
Right. Yeah, I can remember multiple times. I sort of like the idea of math, but I can't say I like it as much as you do. And when it came to playing in odd time signatures, like 9/8 and 7/8 and weird things, if I listened to it, I could do it. But the moment someone told me it was in this time signature and I should count it, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's a real good point because I've played with musicians who, had master degrees in music and all that kind of stuff. But man, you mentioned 7/8 or 5/8 or something. And, you know, but that once again is a matter of breathing.
Right.
You know, in those odd time signatures, you listen and you see how that piece is. I just saw last September a group called Shakti with John McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a group of, you know, classical Indian musicians along with John McLaughlin, who's
the guitar player, right?
Yeah. Let's just say the boy can play, okay?
Yeah.
And my wife went with me. And she, of course, didn't, you know, she doesn't count the odd times. She doesn't know. I'm sitting there listening, I'm thinking, and I'm kind of talking out loud. Oh, yeah, they're killing that seven. You know, and she, She's kind of looking at me. And, you know, and so what I would do, I put my hand on her leg and I was just gently tapping every cycle, you know, not every beat, but just every cycle. And after a while, she was able to get, you know, and then every cycle that it was, you know, she could feel the breath of the music.
Yeah.
And, you know, as in music, so in life, you know, if we tune in to life, we can breathe with it.
Right. You know, and you had mentioned, you know, you mentioned memorizing from music and also flow charts. And that reminds me, you know, we talked a little bit about Sanskrit and I remember reading Vyas Houston and how he memorized the entire, you know, Yoga Sutras.
Yes.
And so I'm just kind of curious how your study of Sanskrit kind of ties into just your spiritual practice in general.
Yeah, I began becoming interested in it just before going to the Institute. It was more out of practicalness, let's say, because I knew that I'd be, from reading Dr. Ladd's book prior to going to the Ayurvedic Institute, I kept encountering these words. And I didn't know how to pronounce some of them, so I would guess. I said, okay, I want to know. And so I found the American Sanskrit Institute and saw that they had intensives in New Jersey. So I called Vyas, and he was very, very kind and accommodating. Oh, yeah, get a plane ticket. Come on over to New Jersey. So I got a plane ticket and went to New Jersey and went to my first intensive, met him, and found out that he was indeed, as we had spoke of before, a friend of Roy's. And listening to him chant, and especially when the group of us were sitting there, even before we had really even got a couple days into it, how he would bring us to chant a simple phrase. And there was a vibratory energy there that was, you could, it was palpable.
Yeah.
And I began to feel this type of vibration is a very organic vibration. Right. And I began to sense that in the language. And then, of course, being with Vyas, who had this own, and like I say, he memorized Patanjali's sutras. And he inspired me to attempt that.
Yeah.
I told Roy. I told Roy, I said, I'm gonna do it, man. I said, Roy, and Roy just looked at me and smiled and said, yes, you know, go ahead. And what I've settled on these days is, I've memorized the first 16 sutras of Pada 1, Pada 2, because that explains the definition in Pada 1 of yoga and the vrittis. And then Pada 2, we talk of the kleshas and et cetera, et cetera. And then selected other verses, you know, dealing with the yamas, niyamas, and then other Sanskrit chants. Sanskrit has become a slow burn for me. You know, it's going to be a lifetime learning process. But I chant every day, even if it's just one shloka. Because it, when I chant the, if I sit and chant the alphabet, which I also do almost daily, just by chanting the alphabet, I can sit in that space after chanting the alphabet. And it'll lead me into my evening quiet time, just sitting, not meditating, just sitting and letting it all settle, sitting in that quiet space. And Vyas wrote that. And when his teacher, of course, was a very advanced scholar. But Vyas said that his teacher got the most joy out of just sitting with a class of students and chanting the alphabet.
Hmm.
And you're talking about someone who's, the man, you know, was Sanskrit.
One who knows.
Yes. And Sanskrit itself, by learning it and tuning into the vibration, the vibrational energy and force of each individual letter, of each individual shloka, sutra, or a particular work, brings about inner, very subtle interchange.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it actually affects the cellular intelligence. We'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
You know, and I would encourage anyone to do that, of course. And I would be remiss not to mention this, Ryan.
Uh-huh.
As we've seen here in the West, there's a bit of appropriation that's gone on with Sanskrit and yoga and so many other things. And as Philip Goldberg, the author of American Veda, a very, very good book, which I think Roy's in that one. Mm-hmm. And to paraphrase him, you know, we in the West are very good at taking sacred things from the East and turning them into a piece of crap.
It's a very good point. But my question to you would be, since you brought that up, I've been thinking about it a lot. Because, you know, you mentioned yoga nidra, and I hear people talking about yoga nidra all the time. And every time I hear how it's described, I cringe a little bit inside. And I was listening to a talk by Swami Veda Bharati, and he's not around anymore, but he had said a similar thing. He said, you know, we take these things and then we don't recognize them in context to the whole system of which they are a part. And so then we lose it. So my question really is this. I don't have an answer. Maybe you do. Yeah. How is it that these things can be presented so that they are digestible to people, yet keeping in mind that, you know, if you tried to go into the whole bit about it, you'd lose everyone. And it kind of also brings up, I remember talking to Vyas, we were emailing and we were talking about like these terms like Kaivalya and these other bigger terms and so on. Yeah. He said, look, you don't need to worry about those until you're at a certain stage. But a lot of people don't really just want, they won't believe it, or they won't fully go into it unless they feel like they have it all. So there's this sort of difficulty between sharing what is necessary while also being true to the entirety of the system. So I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that you bring up a very valid and valuable point there. I'm glad that you introduced that, because it's, you don't want to lose your audience, so to speak, as they say. You know, you want to, as we would say, musically know the room. And so there's a saying in music, and I'll use this analogy. I've spent the last 20, 25 years primarily being a jazz musician. Those are the gigs I get called for, and leading, being a band leader. And I work with a pianist out of San Francisco for many years. He and I are very good friends. We just spoke here about a month ago. And we had a saying between us, which is you give them a little bit of what they know and you give them a little bit of what they don't know.
Mm.
So we would play a gig and we would play some, you know, they would hear, some Kenny G or, you know, some quote unquote jazz.
Uh-huh.
So we give them a little bit of that, and then we sneak in a Miles Davis tune, you know, or something like that. And then we weave another little smooth jazz tune, you know, around that. And then three tunes later, we throw in a Coltrane tune, you know. So we were giving them some of what they knew, and that kept them comfortable enough to keep the butts in the seats.
Mm-hmm.
But every now and then, we would bring them out of their comfort zone. And I found that folks actually, even though they don't realize it at the time, appreciate that.
Mm.
There's a numbness that comes about from getting spoon-fed the same thing over and over and over, even though there may be the thought that, okay, oh yeah, this is comfortable, I'll sit here all night. There's something that works inside that says, come on.
Yeah.
You know? So speaking to what you just brought up, I would say my approach would be some of the same, to bring in, for instance, when I teach beginning Sanskrit classes, you know, if I'm teaching it to yoga teachers, I'll bring in asana names, And, you know, things, you know, instead of, okay, we're going to do triangle pose. No, we're going to, you know, I would say, okay, that's triangle pose, but it's also ikonasana. Mm-hmm. And then we would sit and we would pronounce it together. And so it gives them a connection to what they've learned already, even though it may not be fully fleshed out or partial or a little bit appropriated.
Right.
And so you give them, you work with what they know, which keeps them there. A bit, and then introduce, you know, some of what they don't know in terms of the Sanskrit expressions for the familiar terms that they've been using. And a lot of times you'll see that wide-eyed expression of, oh, that's what that is in Sanskrit. Yes, that's what that, you know, and
right.
And you mean it's not a chakra. It's actually chakra.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, don't you worry. I have plenty of people commenting on my YouTube channel how I don't pronounce chakra correctly.
Oh, really? So, I didn't want to open a wound there, Ryan.
You did. It hit me a little bit in the heart. Chakra. Yeah.
But to, you know, to answer your question in a roundabout way is to you, it's a way, to paraphrase, you meet people where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And begin working in those things. Bringing in those unfamiliarities, but you put them in a familiar suit. And right. Then as we would say in the tech world, as you open the kimono, then, you know, you can then bring in more of the unfamiliar. And then as those two begin to mesh, there, you know, you can then expand a bit.
Right.
A bit more. It can sometimes take a bit of time, depending on on the room, as they say. But
well, one final thing I'm curious about, and it was all sort of stirred up by what we just talked about.
Yeah.
Listening to your experience, find out about Mr. Davis, and then learn Kriya Yoga from him, sounds very similar in some ways to my experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm just putting them together in the sense of when I met Mr. Davis, I just knew he was my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I didn't really concern myself with what other people were saying. It was just, okay, I've got his books. I've got his understanding to listen to and I can spend time with him and hear his words. And so in that situation, it was easier, I feel, to have him meet me where I am, but then introduce new things because I had a sense of trust in him. So I guess my question is, when someone is looking to learn Kriya Yoga or just any spiritual practice where they can really commit to and become involved with, what kind of advice would you give to them about learning from a teacher and sort of growing with that teacher? Like, what was your experience growing with Roy in that way? Did you have a similar experience maybe in the sense of he would stretch you a little bit, but you still kind of went with it because you had seen how his other material worked out?
Mm-hmm. You know, I found that my best friend was patience. I was just last night reading a bit of Roy's writings, and he was speaking of learning meditation, as he taught quite well, as you know. And I could almost hear his voice as I was, you know, it was, you know, a lot of folks who give up on it, they need to stay with it. Just stay with it long enough. Be patient. And to stay with that, that's the one piece I would give to anyone learning, is to be patient. There was something that led you to where you are.
Right.
That put you in front of the teacher that you are in front of now. Trust that. And bring patience to that space. Because whether you know it or not, they've been holding that space for you for a long time.
Right.
And now here you are. So to walk away from it immediately, it may not be the best path for you to trot upon, you know, to, so have patience. Also, something that Roy said, I was listening to one of his recorded lectures, and something that he said about St. Lin, James Lin, a very advanced disciple of Yogananda's. Yogananda was asked, how has St. Lin managed to progress so quickly? And Yogananda's response was, because he asked the right questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully you're not hearing my yard people there. I have a noise.
No, we're okay.
Good. All right.
Yeah.
I rarely asked Roy questions because I found that if I listened, they were answered for the most part. So I would read a little bit of what he had said. I would listen to him, and they were answered. But when I filtered all that out, I knew there was something in me that knew, okay, the question or questions that are left are the right questions.
Right.
So for someone learning, I would say, you know, beginning with a teacher, you know, sometimes we can get, you know, because in school, you know, it's like, you know, you raise your hand and it's like, oh, me, you know, answer my question, me. It's a bit different, you know. Read, listen, allow it to soak in, allow it to translate into your language. Let it speak to you. What's remaining and what's left, then ask your teacher or ask the person you're, and they will gladly, with a smile, because they'll sense the authenticity.
Authenticity, yes.
Yes, thank you.
Authenticity.
Of the authenticity of your question.
Yeah.
So be patient, listen, read, sit in the silence, and allow the answers to present themselves. And the questions that remain, then bring forward.
Excellent. I think that's a good place to end for today.
All right.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you for being with us, Ray.
All right, thanks for inviting me, Ryan.
And if people wanted to get in touch with you, would your website be a good place to go?
Yes, the website is Vibrational Ayurveda.
VibrationalAyurveda.com, yeah.
Yes, and the email address to reach me is there. That's usually how folks I teach do contact me, is through that.
So okay.
That work fine.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you for being here. It was really wonderful to talk to you.
All right. Wonderful speaking with you too, Ryan.